Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. Have you ever been hurt? Ever promised things by someone that never came about? Have you been treated unfairly or misunderstood? Has someone in your past or present ever done something that would cause you to say, I can never forgive them? What does forgiveness mean anyway? Does it mean that what the person did to hurt you was okay, or that you won't feel hurt anymore? Maybe it means not dwelling on the event. What about what Jesus said about turning the other cheek? Does that mean the person can keep on hurting you and you should just take it? And finally, what about justice and revenge? My guest today has spent the last 30 years coming up with solid empirical answers to those and many other questions surrounding forgiveness. He faced this issue head-on when in 1995, on New Year's Eve, his mother was brutally murdered in her home, beaten to death with a crowbar. Dr. Worthington faced a choice: forgive the killers and apply all that he'd learned about forgiveness to this unspeakable crime, or live in bitterness and despair. He's here today to tell us that forgiveness is not only possible, but highly necessary for us to walk in the freedom and rest God has designed for us. Dr. Worthington is professor of psychology at Virginia Commonwealth University. He's also a licensed clinical psychologist. He's published over 25 books and over 250 articles and scholarly chapters, mostly on forgiveness, marriage, and family topics. Dr. Worthington, welcome to Heartline.
It's good to be with you, Rita.
Yours is an amazing story of forgiveness. You spent years studying this subject, and then this catastrophic event occurs, the brutal murder of your mother. Could you share what happened and maybe talk about how, with all you'd learned and taught about forgiveness, you were able to get through such a traumatic event?
Well, we had been studying forgiveness for probably 6 or 7 years, of course, I had dealt with forgiveness with married couples for quite a number of years before that. And then on a New Year's Eve night, a young man broke into my mom's house, thinking that the house must have been empty because she was asleep and she didn't drive, so there was no car in the driveway. And then when she awakened and came out into the hallway and apparently confronted him, he bludgeoned her with a crowbar until she died. Was angry and actually assaulted her sexually with a wine bottle that he had with him. So it was a pretty brutal thing. He was very distraught, apparently, because he ran through the house and even the rooms that he didn't search. He broke all the mirrors in the house, so it seemed like he just couldn't look himself in the face after doing this. So that was, you know, the kind of the genesis of that event that happened on New Year's Eve 1995, or New Year's, New Year's morning 1996.
And how did you deal with this? I mean, shock, numbness, obviously all those emotions working together when you learned about it.
Right. I was definitely shocked. I was angry. This happened in Knoxville, Tennessee. I live in Richmond, Virginia. So my sister and her husband and I drove down into the midst of the murder investigation that first day. And, you know, it was a chaotic experience. And, you know, they took us over to the house trying to see if there were valuables missing that we knew about. And, of course, the devastation of having someone break into your house and search it. You know, there were things thrown all over the place. And then, of course, there was the hallway where her body had been discovered and blood on the walls and on the carpet. And it was a pretty horrendous sight. So, you know, the first day was just a kind of a jumble of run here, run there, police coming in, questioning folks. Not me, I was in Richmond, of course, but, you know, they're trying to get people's perspective on, you know, what was up and what had happened. And, you know, by that night, we were pretty much piecing together a story that was emerging from the police investigation, and that was that apparently a youth had been outside and had thought that the house was empty, had broken in, and then this was a robbery, a burglary gone awry, and so he had stolen some money that was available, and so there was missing money, and some evidence was found. The wine bottle was found, a kind of a change sorter was found nearby, so there was some evidence that showed that it was a burglary.
When did anger start to rise up in you? Really? I mean, from discovering something like this, seeing this, you probably felt shock and numbness, like you said, but then at some point, did rage just take over you?
Well, I would say, you know, Richmond is a little over 7 hours' drive from Knoxville, and by the time we got down to Knoxville, we had done a lot of reminiscing, and we had also kind of started to feel the anger of this. Walking through the house and seeing kind of the scene of the violence kind of set us back into a shocked numbness again, because you can kind of imagine that, but then when you see what violence has happened and you just see this physical evidence, it's a kind of an intrusion of reality again. So I think it was probably late that night. My brother, sister, and I were in the back room putting our heads together about what happened. And that's when the rage really became pretty fierce. You know, I remember pointing to a baseball bat that was leaning up against the wall and saying, "I wish that whoever did this were here. I would beat his brains out." Mm. I said he wouldn't last 30 minutes. In my brother said he wouldn't last 10 minutes with me, and my sister said I'd make him last an hour. You know, we were just absolutely furious. All of us were, and of course I couldn't sleep after that. I spent the entire night walking around, pacing around the bedroom of my aunt's house where I was spending the night.
So when did the first thoughts of, okay, I'm a researcher who's studying forgiveness, I need to think about forgiveness, when did that thought first cross your mind? Was it days, weeks, months?
Well, actually, it was that first night, and I had spent all night kind of pacing around and could see that I was just raging. And about 3 a.m., you know, I sat down on the bed and thought, I've got to do something productive. I'm just, you know, it's not doing anybody any good for me to just kind of stomp around the bedroom here. So I started trying to compose a eulogy for Mom, because I'm the oldest of the three children, and so my dad was already died a number of years before, and so I was going to kind of give a eulogy at Mom's funeral. And so as I sat there thinking about her life and, you know, what she had poured into us, that's when the thought really first occurred. You know, here I've spent almost 24 hours since hearing about this, and I have never even thought the F word, forgiveness. You know, so I was like ashamed that here I, as a researcher who had studied forgiveness, as someone who had just really delivered a book on forgiveness to InterVarsity Press about a month before that, the first draft of that book, you know, and yet I'm not even willing to think about forgiveness. Hmm. And so that was kind of a wake-up call where I said, well, you know, we've taught thousands of people to forgive using a five-step method to reach forgiveness, where reach is an acrostic that kind of cues memory for the steps. So we've taught thousands of people this method that works for people. Can I try it on myself? Well, I tried it on many things that were not near as hard to forgive. So, you know, whether it worked for something really big, I just didn't have any idea whether it would work. And so I set about then that night trying to work through those steps as much as I could in a brief period of time.
Can you give us a working definition of forgiveness and unforgiveness, so folks are clear on that?
Sure. I think that there are two different types of forgiveness. They're not really two halves of forgiveness, but two different types. One is a decision to forgive. So we call it decisional forgiveness, and it is a decision that I am going to not get revenge on this person, and I am going to do my best to treat this person as a valued person. So it's a statement about how I hope to behave in the future. I may never get to behave that way, because the other person may do something to interrupt that, or circumstances may never let me behave in that way. Person may move away or die or something like that. But forgiveness is that what psychologists call a behavioral intention statement, a decisional forgiveness. But a person can make a decision to behave in a way that values the other person and still be very resentful and angry and bitter and fearful when thinking about it. And that's what we call unforgiveness, emotional unforgiveness. You know, not all injustices end up with unforgiveness. So some injustices get taken care of without needing to be forgiven, because justice gets served, or the person decides to forbear or to just accept and move on with their life. So injustices can get, you know, dealt with in lots of different ways, but sometimes that negative emotion of bitterness, resentment, hostility, hatred, anger, and fear will build up, and that's what we call emotional unforgiveness. So that suggests that there has to be a second kind of forgiveness. And it may be related to a decision to forgive, but it's not joined at the hip. I could have a decision without the emotional forgiveness, the second type. So the second type of forgiveness, emotional forgiveness, you know, we believe to be the emotional replacement of negative, unforgiving emotions with positive, other-oriented emotions, like empathy for the person who hurt me, or if I can't manage that, maybe sympathy, I feel sorry for them, or maybe compassion for someone who would do such a terrible thing, or even love. So two types of forgiveness, often related but not necessarily related. They can occur in either order. So you can make a decision first, or you could actually experience an emotional change first and then later come back and make a decision. Or just live with one and not the other.
So were you able to take those hot, unforgiving emotions, as you've called them, of bitterness, rage, anger, all of that, and replace that with sympathy or compassion for the perpetrator of your mother's death? Was that something you consciously started to do to begin the steps?
Right. That was the process of working through this five steps to reach forgiveness. And on one hand, it's, I think, very rare to be able to do that, and it's not real. I wasn't able to do it because I'm some kind of super forgiver. I often will say that when I was in graduate school, I had a professor give me a B, and it took 10 years to forgive him for giving me a B. So, you know, it's not like I'm some kind of uber forgiver. But in this particular case, my emotions were heightened, and so once I kind of started down that road of thinking through what it must have been like for the other, you know, for the guy who did this, and, you know, how he must have been afraid that he was going to jail, and he must have been angry that his perfect crime was being broken up, and, you know, and then realizing that I had stood there that very night and pointed to a baseball bat and said, I'm not an adolescent with an impulse control problem. I'm an adult Christian scientist who studied forgiveness, therapist who's helped people forgive, and yet I'm willing to point at that baseball bat and say with all my heart, I wish whoever did that were here. I would hit him in the head until he died, just like he had hit my mom in the head until she died. I would do this deliberately, and I you know, just came to the emotional realization that, you know, if my darkness of heart could be forgiven by God, if I, repented of that, then who was I to hold unforgiveness toward this young man? You know, I needed to release that. I needed to, you know, experience that emotional forgiveness and just let God deal with him and not, you know, not have to think that I could somehow deal with him by holding hate in my heart.
Okay, so back to the reach. R means recall the hurt.
Right. So we, you know, people have to recall the hurt. They have to recall it in a different way than indulging themselves in what a jerk this person is or how much I've been damaged. So they have to recall it in a way that promotes some kind of more positive emotion toward the person, so more empathy with the person, or at least get to the place where they can feel sorry for the person. So E is to emotionally replace the negative, unforgiving emotions with more positive emotions. Sometimes we call that just the empathy step, but really that's a shorthand for building empathy or sympathy or compassion or love for the person. It's emotionally replacing the negative. Now, this takes a long time. Yeah, I mean, it's so easy to say this in about 10 seconds. It's so hard to do and takes, you know, hours to do. The third step is A, give an altruistic gift of forgiveness. Now, I can forgive because I come to a realization that it is not hurting the person who offended me to hold a grudge against them. It's just hurting me.
So forgiveness is for my benefit.
Right. I can forgive to some degree, coming at it by what science has shown us, that forgiveness has physical health benefits, mental health benefits, relational benefits, and even spiritual benefits. But the most lasting and the deepest forgiveness is going to come about with a different motivation too. And that is a motivation that I can bless this person who hurt me. You know, I can loose something in the heavens, and if I loose it on earth, it's loosed in the heavens. Or I can just hold on to this and I can bind it on earth and it's bound in the heaven. So I want to be able to set people free to the extent that I can contribute to that. I want to give an altruistic gift. And it turns out that the science shows that the amount of forgiveness that people can actually experience is more when they're coming at this altruistically rather than self-interested. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't forgive for our own benefit, too. We should. You know, we should forgive for both. It's just like I should become a Christian for my own benefit, but also so that I can bless others and so that I can bless God. You know, not in the way that I'm doing something for God, but I'm pleasing God. So there are, you know, there's self-interested motives for being a Christian, but that's not the highest motive. The highest motive is really, you know, for God and for others. So, but all of those are legitimate motives, and the same is true with forgiveness. So that's the A step. So recall the hurt, emotionally replace the negative with the positive, give an altruistic gift of forgiveness as well as self-interested forgiveness. C is commit to the forgiveness you experience. You know, say it aloud. Write yourself a note that you've forgiven. Do some kind of ritual, like write on a piece of paper and burn it up and offer prayers for this person. You know, so that it's more than just I decided in my mind that I forgave this person. And the reason that we do that is because of the last step. It helps us, H, hold on to that forgiveness whenever we doubt that we've forgiven. And we will doubt it because our bodies are set up so that if we got hurt in a situation and we see that situation again, our body will respond. That's the way God had made us. God made us so that we go, be careful, you got hurt there again before, and you can get hurt there again. So if I have been hurt by my boss, and I forgive my boss, and I walk into work and I see my boss, my body will go, wow, you know, you're angry. And I'll think right away, oh, I must not have forgiven. That's not right. That's my body saying, you got hurt by her before, be careful, you'll get hurt by her again. So, you know, it doesn't disqualify our forgiveness at all. It's just something to be thankful for that God made us so that we don't walk out into traffic or we don't enter into some other dangerous situation that can kill us.
Well, let me ask you something else before you go on while we're on this. Do you think some people are just intrinsically born more forgiving than others? I mean, I think I have a tendency to be a pretty forgiving person, and yet I know people that just will say, I just have a hard time, I hold a grudge, I just the way I am.
Well, okay, so let's just say that by personality, there are definitely some people who have high trait forgivingness and other people who have low, and most people are someplace in the middle. Now, whether that's something they're born with is a very different question. So there's actually been genetic research that shows that people can have a genetic disposition that aims them at forgiveness. But that doesn't mean that they're going to be forgiving. You know, I could have a genetic disposition that is to build muscles like Arnold Schwarzenegger. But if I never go work out, I will never have muscles like Arnold Schwarzenegger, regardless of what kind of genetic disposition I have. And if people can have a genetic predisposition toward being forgiving, or they can have a genetic disposition that says, boy, it's really hard to forgive. But if they practice forgiving, you know, it's going to be harder for the person who's going against their genetics, but they can get there. It's just like if I have my body type, which is not Arnold Schwarzenegger's, I can still build muscle mass by going and working out.
But you have to be intentional about it, yeah.
Right. I won't look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I'll look better than I, you know, looked as a 97-pound weakling. So anyway, you know, like I say, people do have different personalities that predispose them, but whether they learned that or practiced it or their family contributed to it or whatever, they're not stuck mm-hmm. in their personality. You know, we can build virtues of all kinds, forgiveness being one of them. And the way that we build those virtues is to practice them until they become second nature, and then to put them under test the same way that if I wanted to build my muscles, I put them under control test. I, you know, lift weights. And that gets me to the place where if life throws me a challenge and I have to lift a heavy object, then I'm prepared to lift that heavy object because I put myself under the test necessary. You know, I've tried to work to forgive all the little things. And then if I have to forgive the big thing, my muscles, my forgiveness muscles, if you will, are strong enough to do a little more heavy lifting.
Great point. Ev, we're out of time for today. You've graciously agreed to come back and join us next week to talk about forgiving ourselves.
Yeah.
In the meantime, any of Dr. Worthington's books can be ordered on my website at siftedaswheat.com by going to the Heartline podcast page. I recommend starting with Forgiving and Reconciling. Ev, we'll see you next time. God bless.
Yeah, see you.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.